For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
We think of Jesus on the cross. Some of his final words were these. Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Even critics of the Bible look at this passage and they say, we don't know, you know, as a skeptic, we don't know if everything in the Gospels is true. This part, even the skeptics will say, definitely was true. Because nobody in their right mind would ever write these words and put them on the lips of Jesus as a Christian. Why would you have this incredible, spectacular figure moving all the way through the Gospels, and then at the end, right at the final moment, he cries out. And the word there is to shriek out in a loud voice, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus definitely said this, according to historians of all stripes, Christian or critical. Why would he say this in his final moments on the cross and to shriek it? You know, in crucifixion, what it does is it actually asphyxiates you, because as you're hanging there from the cross, you slump and it closes the respiratory cavity, and then you have to lift yourself up and then slump and then slump, and you basically just do that until eventually you asphyxiate and die. And so Jesus must have pulled himself up and shrieked, my God, why have you forsaken me? And everyone there was hearing this. Why would he say that? Was he doubting God? Is that what was happening here? In fact, no, he wasn't doubting God. In fact, he was quoting God. He was quoting Psalm chapter 22, where the first verse reads, my God, why have you forsaken me? Far from my deliverance are the words of my groaning. The Bible at this point, the Hebrew Bible, it wasn't broken up into chapter divisions, and it wasn't numbered. So you couldn't say, like, open up to Deuteronomy 23. The Psalms were just a collection of songs, and the way that the rabbis would cite a psalm was to cite the first line. That's the way that they would cite a psalm. And so that's what Jesus, as a first century Palestinian rabbi, was doing here. He was just citing the first line of the psalm. It'd be like today, like if you heard, you know, a line from a song like this, you know, I stay out too late, got nothing in my brain. That's what people say. I go on too many dates, but I can't make them stay. That's what people say. If you heard somebody say that, you'd be thinking to yourself, but I keep cruising, won't stop, I don't know the rest of the words, but you probably do. You'd be like, that's Taylor Swift, I know that song. And in this culture, this was a religious culture, and they knew these songs. So they'd be sitting there thinking, why would he quote this psalm? Well, let's read the psalm that Jesus wanted us to read. Read in verse 2, oh my God, I cry by day, but you did not answer, and by night, but I have no rest. Yet you are holy, O you who are enthroned upon the praises of Israel, and you, our fathers, trusted. They trusted, and you delivered them. To you they cried out and were delivered. In you they trusted and were not disappointed. So much the idea that this is, you know, Jesus giving up trust in his final moments. He's quoting a psalm that's talking about how to trust God in your final moments. In fact, as we continue to read, he says, I am but a worm and not a man, scorned by men and despised by the people. So this is poetic language, it's a psalm. All who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. He trusts in the Lord. So he is trusting in the Lord. He's not doubting God here. Let the Lord rescue him then. Yeah. Here's the one who's trusting in God and yet he's forsaken. Let the Lord rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. Oh, that's interesting. As a Bible reader, when I have my Bible open, I see that when Jesus was on the cross, this is precisely what the religious leaders were saying. And there's a deep level of irony. They're saying, yeah, he could save others. He can't save himself. It was in that very moment that Jesus wasn't saving himself that he was saving others on the cross. We read in verse 9, yea, you are he who brought me forth from the womb. You made me trust when upon my mother's breasts. Upon you I was cast from birth. You have been my God from my mother's womb. This is from David. He's the same one who wrote that, you know, from the womb I was conceived in sin. And yet here he's saying, as a baby, this figure, this suffering person, trusted God while he was still on his mother's breast, being breastfed. That's kind of interesting. So he had faith as a baby. It refers to his mother twice. It never refers to his human father. That's peculiar. Like in Jewish culture, it was a patriarchal culture. You know, patri, father. And so you would go from the father's line. Here it's mentioning the mother, not the father. As you read through the Hebrew Bible, we don't have a single reference in the Hebrew Bible to the Messiah's father. In a patriarchal culture. And here we see the same thing. Mention of the mother without a father involved. Verse 11. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, for there is none to help. He's completely abandoned. Many bulls have surrounded me. Strong bulls of Bashan have encircled me. They open wide their mouth at me as a ravening and roaring lion. Later, we see that these enemies are referred to as a lion, which isn't a bull, and a dog, which isn't a bull. And later in verse 16, we see specifically that these are referred to as a band of evildoers. So this is poetic imagery. Again, what's the genre that we're reading? It's poetry. And as we read in passages such as Isaiah 34, Ezekiel 39, bulls are usually symbols of enemies. And so the bulls are enemies surrounding this righteous sufferer. So these are people, apparently. He writes in verse 14, I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within me. So he's surrounded by enemies. There's none to help. He's crying out to God. People are mocking him. And now he says, my bones are out of joint. What is that talking about? Well, interestingly enough, according to medical doctors, during crucifixion, this dislocates the shoulders and the elbows an additional 6 inches in length. And so it's just a gruesome, horrific picture. My bones are out of joint. I'm poured out like water. He goes on to say in verse 15, my strength is dried up like a potsherd. A potsherd is a broken piece of pottery. It can't hold water. And my tongue cleaves to my jaws, and you lay me in the dust of death. So he's dehydrated. That's what this is saying. All the water is flowing out of him. And in crucifixion, this is exactly what would have happened. You know, Jesus was scourged before he went on the cross. And so the blood was coming out of him. He was dehydrated. He was in the hot heat of Israel, middle of the day. And in John 19:28, he says, I am thirsty. Of course he was. Then verse 16, he says, for dogs have surrounded me. Remember, we studied the synonymous parallelism. For dogs have surrounded me. What's the next strophe? A band of evildoers has encompassed me. So there's evildoers around him. And check this out. These evildoers have pierced my hands and my feet. This is a piece of literature which was written 5 centuries before the method of crucifixion was even invented. Crucifixion wasn't invented in a primitive form until 519 BC by the Persians. And it wasn't really mastered. Like, they didn't really master this method of execution until the Romans, about 200 BC at the earliest. So this is predicting a method of death, the piercing of the hands and the feet, a millennium before Jesus lived, and 5 centuries before the world had ever seen this happen, piercing the hands and the feet. I can count all my bones. They look, they stare at me. I don't know what this means exactly. Is it that he's just naked? They can count all his bones, just laid out there, stretched out. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. Yeah, that's what all 4 Gospels say, is that at the cross the soldiers were gambling for Jesus' clothing. But you, O Lord, be not far off. O you, my help, hasten to my assistance. Deliver my soul from the sword, my only life from the power of the dog. Save me from the lion's mouth, from the horns of the wild oxen. You answer me. I will tell of your name to my brethren in the midst of the assembly. I will praise you. That's interesting. So far, the tense of all these verbs has been in the present tense or the past tense. They pierced my hands and feet. Here, this is shifting to the future. So earlier it said, you lay me in the dust of death, that I've been pierced through, that he's basically dead. Okay. Now here he's saying, I will still speak to you amidst all these people. And so this would fit with the idea that Jesus didn't just die at the cross, but that he also rose from the dead on the third day. And you'll see here, this fits quite nicely. You who fear the Lord, praise him. All you descendants of Jacob, glorify him and stand in awe of him, all you descendants of Israel. For those of us reading this, what is it about this righteous sufferer's death, you know, somebody having their hands and feet pierced and being poured out like water and being killed, what is it about that that would make you want to stand in awe of God? That just seems like a non sequitur, like the premises don't lead to the conclusion. I don't get it. Why would this connect at all? For he has not despised nor abhorred the affliction of the afflicted, nor has he hidden his face from him. But when he cried out to him for help, he heard. From you comes my praise in the great assembly. I shall pay my vows before those who fear him. The afflicted will eat and be satisfied. Those who seek him will praise the Lord. Let your heart live forever. All the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord. And all the families of the nations will worship before you. What is it about this righteous sufferer's death that it's going to spread to the entire earth, like all the nations, the goyim, the Gentile peoples? What is it about this person's, what does this have to do with any of that? For the kingdom is the Lord's, and he rules over all the nations. All the prosperous of the earth will eat and worship. All those who go down before him to the dust of death, even he who cannot keep his soul alive. This might be an even more incredible prediction than the first part, because we're seeing this fulfilled in our very day. Experts tell us that in China, 30,000 people meet Christ per day. Christianity in Africa went from about, I don't know, a few million to half a billion people in a century. It was something on the order of 60-fold growth in Africa. And you see the same thing in Latin America. You see the same thing across the world. And it makes you feel kind of perplexed, I guess, when you think about that. We have all these, you know, Africans, Asians, Caucasians, Hispanics, people from all across the world who believe in the Jewish God. So weird. You know, of all the gods we could believe in, you know, Baal, Molech, Hercules, Zeus, people on the order of billions of people across the world believe in the Jewish God. They read the Jewish Bible, the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament. They read that as their history. They believe in Jesus, Yeshua, the Christ, the Messiah. They believe in a Jewish rabbi. Isn't that a little bit odd? Like, let's just raise our hands here. How many people here do not come from an ethnically Jewish background? Okay, that's quite a bit. Why are so many good Gentile people like us worshiping a Jewish guy? Has that ever struck you as kind of odd? It says so right here. Now, this is for Jewish people and Gentile people like us. Everyone's welcome here. But man, that's kind of strange. And yet, 2,000 years later, really 3,000 years later, after this was written, here we see it. Well, he concludes, our children will also serve him. Future generations will hear about the wonders of the Lord. They will come and will declare his righteousness to a people who will be born, that he has performed it. So this is talking about the future, and that God is going to do something for future generations, that all the nations are going to hear about this. Why? What is it about this sufferer's death that he has performed it, or in the words of Jesus, it is finished, tetelestai. Interesting. Now, at this point, I've talked to some people who are skeptics, and they say, wait a minute, I see how this works. So Jesus and the disciples, they had this book, yeah, the Psalms. So they read this, and they just self-fulfilled it. There's nothing, you think this is some kind of evidence for Jesus or something? That's real cute, but I mean, come on. They had this Bible. They were Jews, and they read their Bible, and they read it, and it said that, you know, pierce the hands and the feet. And they self-fulfilled this to create a religion. I remember when I first saw this, that was my first inkling too. I came from kind of a skeptical background. And I thought, this is just, I know something about this. It just fits too well. They probably self-fulfilled it. Then I thought to myself, why on earth would anybody want to self-fulfill being crucified? Did you know that our modern term, excruciate, comes from the Latin root excruciatus? It means ex, from, and then cruciatus, the cross. Crucifixion, according to ancient Jewish sources, was the worst form of torture. As for the closest disciples of Jesus, like Paul, for example, he went to his death, he was beheaded by the Roman authorities. You like that? He was killed. Peter, Jesus' other closest disciple, he was crucified. He was murdered. And then Jesus' half-brother, James, he was thrown down the temple stairs, and then he was clubbed to death like an animal. That comes from Josephus, a non-Christian source in Book 20, Section 200. Now, let's think about that for a second. Jesus' closest disciples, they didn't get women, they didn't get wealthy, they didn't get power, they didn't get anything out of this. There's no reports of Jesus having sex, no reports of Jesus getting women, wealth. He says, you know, that the foxes have dens, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Paul, same thing. He says, you know, you guys have really arrived, 1 Corinthians 4, but us, the apostles, we're the dregs of the earth. We're poor. What's the motive of doing this? Why would you go to the cross? Why would you go to your death? I mean, think about James, Jesus' half-brother. Some of us here are brothers. How much would it take to convince you that your half-brother was the Son of God, God incarnate, the Savior of the earth, right? It'd be a pretty tall order for me to believe that. I mean, growing up with him your whole life, you'd see him with your own eyes. That would take something incredible, and James went to his death, clubbed to death in belief in his brother Jesus. Self-fulfilled? What would be the motive? No, that just doesn't make any sense. Other people have come back and they've said, well, this can't be about Jesus. Why not? Because the text says so. See, you were being a little bit manipulative there. You just started in verse 1, but you didn't read the superscription. For the choir director, a psalm of David. This is written by David. And so the psalm, he's speaking in the first person about himself. This must be about David. I got problems with that. I got lots of problems. But this is about David. For one, this can't be about David. You know why? Because David never died this way. That's why. David never died with his hands and feet being pierced and being poured out and his joints being dislocated. Do you know how much literature we have on David in the Bible? 1st, 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, the 73 Psalms, voluminous amount of literature on David. Not a word about this. Nothing about his hands and feet being pierced. All we have is that David died peacefully in 1 Kings chapter 2. He was surrounded by friends and family. He died of old age. He didn't die this way. Secondly, many of David's Psalms were predictive prophecy. So some people say, well, this is David writing it. Yes, but David wrote Psalms which were predictive in nature. In 2 Samuel chapter 23, David said that the Holy Spirit is upon my tongue and I speak his words out of my mouth. David was an inspired author. As we go through these Psalms, Psalm 2, interpreters of all stripes, you know, Jewish, Christian, critical, they believe that's a messianic psalm that's going to be fulfilled at the end of history. Psalm 16, Psalm 110. In fact, the Qumran community, which was a sect of Judaism that left Jerusalem, they went out by themselves out there and they decided they're going to have their own little religion. We got literature from them which says that David composed his Psalms, quote, through prophecy, which was given him from before the Most High. They believed that the Psalms were prophetic literature. This is before the time of Christ. Number three, David's death didn't have a global impact. How many people across the world worship David, King David? You know, how many Jewish people were out there who influenced so many Gentile people to come to worship the God of Israel? It's a pretty short list. It's one, Jesus of Nazareth. There's really only one explanation as to why so many Gentile people believe in the God of Israel. It's Jesus. That's why, not David. And so this can't be about David. And in fact, the second half of the Psalms, the grammar, I mean, we could go on and on about this, it's referring to the future. So it's clearly predictive. Okay, other people come back and they say that part about they pierced my hands and feet in verse 16, that really, really shouldn't be pierced, because we have some manuscripts, the Masoretic text, which is our best series of texts, it's a collection of texts. It doesn't say pierced, it says like a lion. They like a lion, my hands and feet, is what it really says. And the difference is pretty subtle. In Hebrew, I put this up here so you could see it. You see how they're identical? Except for that first letter. In fact, in Hebrew, it's backwards, but in our eye, the first letter, it's like over and down versus just over like an apostrophe. So the difference is between ka-aru, which means pierced, versus ka-ari, which means like a lion. And so people have argued this isn't about crucifixion, because the original manuscripts, they say ka-ari, like a lion. Let's just say that we pulled that verse out. Let's just say we said, okay, yeah, that was referring to like a lion, my hands and feet. This still would be pretty good prophecy. I mean, it's describing being surrounded by people, being laughed at, being mocked, being killed, having the water drain out of you, people gambling for your clothing, this still would be a good picture of crucifixion. So this would be damaged by this objection, but it wouldn't be destroyed. And yet, there's no good reason to think that it isn't referring to pierced. I got three reasons why. First, the oldest Jewish translation, which dates anywhere from 250 BC to 132 BC in that period. So we're talking about at least or right around 200 years before Christ, if not further. It's called the Septuagint. It was a bunch of Jewish rabbis, 70 of them, who translated the Hebrew Bible, their Bible, into Greek. And when they translated this word, they translated it pierced. They didn't translate it as like a lion. They have words for that in Greek. They didn't use them. They used the word aruso. Second, our oldest Hebrew copy of this specific verse. Now we got Psalm 22, which goes back earlier, years before Christ. But this verse is missing. Recently, in 1997, I mean fairly recently, they found this verse, and it's our oldest manuscript of this specific verse, Psalm 22:16, and guess what it says? Ka-aru, pierced, not ka-ri. And this was found in the Qumran community, separate from Jesus and separate from Israel. What was happening there? Then, third, pierced makes grammatical sense. This is kind of obvious. There's no verb in that sentence. They, like a lion, what does that even mean? Think about that for a second. They like a lion. What is this, like a Tarzan here, where we just talk, you, me, Jane, love, you know? The grammatical sense is they pierced. That's the verb in the sentence. And so for all intents and purposes, this is talking about pierced. And this is predicted right all the way back before the time of Christ. Other people who are radical skeptics, they say, well, you know, Jesus couldn't have fulfilled this. And you're like, why not? They're like, well, Jesus never existed. I've been shocked to hear this as a student of history, that people would make such a bald assertion that Jesus never existed. Jesus never existed? Jesus is the most influential person in human history. He never existed. You know, we've got a couple biographies on some of the ancient emperors. One for Alexander the Great. It's written 450 years after he died in 323 BC. We've got four biographies for Jesus. We've got multiple sources. I've got so much evidence for it. It's so much, in fact, that even atheistic historians, okay, who don't believe in God, like John Dominic Crossan, he's one of the most extreme skeptics on this. He said that Jesus was crucified is as sure as anything historical can ever be. This guy is not on our side of the fence here, okay? But this part, the crucifixion of Christ, yes, he was crucified. Bart Ehrman, who is, you know, definitely anti-Christian, debates Christians. He's an atheistic New Testament scholar. He says, quote, one of the most certain facts of history is that Jesus was crucified. Certain facts of history. Gerd Ludemann, he's a German New Testament atheistic historian. He says, quote, Jesus' death as a consequence of crucifixion is indisputable. Now, I don't know if you read scholarship, but these are the kind of words they don't like to use. They always like to say it may have been this, it could have been that. It's always these real subjunctive, I don't know, possibly, maybe. When you have people on the complete other extreme of the perspective saying words like, as sure as anything can ever be, and indisputable, that's good evidence. No, actually, that's not good evidence. The evidence should speak for itself. But when you have scholars like this saying this, you better have some pretty good evidence that Jesus never existed. And so, let's think about this. In fact, let's end the way that we started. We're thinking of these words from Jesus. He's on the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? Did you know that in every other recorded prayer in the Bible, Jesus always, always, always refers to God as his Father? Every single time. Except here. You might say, why? Why wouldn't he say, Father, why have you forsaken me? Instead, he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? People who say, yeah, that just shows Jesus was losing it in his final moments, then you're completely missing it. You've missed the point. Do you see what this is saying? This is saying that Jesus was willing to give up his Father so that you could have him as your Father. Or to put that a different way, the Father was willing to give up his Son so that you could become his Son. Jesus was forsaken. He took all of the moral violations, all of the incredibly wicked things that we've ever done, he took that unto himself, and God judged him in our place. You know, we deserved it. We deserved to be judged, and yet God judged him in our place so that he was forsaken. He took on the judgment for sin, and we got off. But there's just one part of this. I've heard some people say these little, you know, tropes. God's love is unconditional. I've heard that before. Not true. There's one condition. One and only one condition. It's that you need to receive his love. And so God sets the bar so low, even a child could understand this. You know, there's a risk that we have here as we start to think about, you know, evidence and arguments for why, you know, Jesus is real. There's a risk that this could turn into some kind of an argumentative thing. And I want to put that on the table for a second and just say, wait a minute. If this could be true, that you could come to know God, like you could receive the gift of Christ, wouldn't you want to come to know your Creator? And as I said, God put the bar so low that even a little child could grasp it. You don't need to be some kind of a, you know, incredible intellectual to get this. It's just that I have morally violated other people. And God says that he paid for that on the cross. And all I need to do is receive that. And if you do that, what you get is what Jesus deserved. And Jesus says, I took what you deserved on the cross.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.